The slums will soon be a memory. We will turn our prisons into factories and our jails into storehouses. Men will walk upright, women will smile, and children will laugh. Hell will forever be for rent. These words of happy, if not delirious, prophecy were spoken nearly 90 years ago by the evangelist, the Reverend Billy Sunday. He truly believed what he said. He really was envisioning a new America, a land free of slums, where prisons would be converted into factories or storehouses, one with upright men, smiling women, and laughing children, and to top it all off, everybody would be so good that nobody would even go to hell anymore. Wow. Well, what was about to take place that would cause a fire and brimstone evangelist like the Reverend Mr. Sunday to have such an outburst of utopianism? Well, he was heralding the arrival of what we now call America's noble experiment, also known as Prohibition. On January the 16th, 1920, the 18th Amendment to the United States Constitution took effect, making the sale and purchase of alcoholic beverages illegal. It had been passed into law 1 year earlier, 90 years ago, this past January. With one of my sideline avocations being that of an American history buff, I've been taking a look at this rather fascinating era in our nation's history as it ran from 1920 until the 18th Amendment was repealed in 1933. And one of the things I have taken from these explorations is yet another reminder of how popular stereotypes and images can really override the reality of a given situation. The image of the prohibitionist is that of the fiery Bible-waving preacher a la Billy Sunday railing against the evils of drink, or that of Carrie Nation terrorizing the patrons of saloons as she and her cohort smash bottles of booze with their axes. As is the case with much phenomenon of this kind, or with the case of much phenomena of this kind, reality is far more complex than the popular image. For even with its Billy Sundays and its Carrie Nations, prohibition was in many quarters considered a progressive cause. It was part and parcel of the larger liberal reform sentiment that was very strong as America entered the 20th century. It was part and parcel with such progressive movements as women's rights, the abolition of child labor, and the advocacy of world peace. We can find ample evidence of this by looking no further than into the universalist side of our Unitarian Universalist family tree. At its 1917 General Conference, which was one of the forerunners of our current General Assembly, the Universalist Church of America adopted what it called a social program. This social program, again, was a predecessor, one of the predecessors, of our current General Assembly resolutions. And that 1917 Universalist Social Program was a very noble document. It called for, among other things, the reconstruction of the world's civilizations in terms of justice, peace, and righteousness. It called for housing, food, education, and recreation for every child. And for women, it called for equal economic, social, and political rights. And there in the midst of all these very worthy aspirations, we also find this clause. We recognize in the use of narcotic habit-forming drugs an imminent peril to social welfare. We therefore recommend action towards securing national prohibition of the manufacture and sale of alcoholic liquors. Well, such a prohibition, as we know, did come to pass. But did its advocates, who really span the whole religious spectrum, as you can see here, did they really get what they wanted? One need not be a history buff to know what ensued after 1920. It is well summed up in a 1990 report published by the conservative-leaning Cato Institute, written by Auburn University professor Mark Thornton, quote, "Alcohol became more dangerous to consume. Crime increased and became organized. The court and prison systems were stretched to the breaking point. Corruption of public officials was rampant. Prohibition removed a significant source of tax revenue and greatly increased government spending." Somehow, Neither Billy Sunday, nor our very well-intentioned and well-motivated Universalist ancestors quite saw all that coming. Well, there's more than one, as you can imagine, there is more than one object lesson here. I have spoken before on the limits of the law when it comes to dealing with certain kinds and enforcing certain kinds of moral behavior or prohibiting it. And I've spoken then of the need to realistically distinguish between what does in fact need to be prohibited and strongly punished, things like murder, rape, and theft, for example, and what can only or best be regulated. The lessons of prohibition to me seem to remain to this day lost on what is still called war on drugs, for example. Where more lives continue to be lost or shattered in the violence of the illicit drug trade than are affected by the illegal drugs themselves, harmful and dangerous and deadly as some of them truly are. A blanket legal prohibition of abortion, as morally indefensible as I know a certain segment of our society finds that practice to be, would, as I look at it, create the same kind of deadly and dangerous underground market for this procedure as prohibition did with respect to the manufacture and purchase of alcohol. So what do we ban and what do we regulate as a matter of civil law? Is one of those ongoing debates in the realms of both the law and morality that we will continue to have as we strive to ever create a more safe and civil society. But that's not the primary object lesson I wish to pursue this morning. The question I want to explore instead for a little bit of time here is why good intentions do not always yield good results. And why a morally or ethically driven motivation does not in and of itself guarantee the best moral or ethical outcome. It really was fascinating. I went back and dug out some of my old Universalist history stuff off the shelf this past week, and it was fascinating to read that 1917 social document that our really wonderful Universalist precursors drafted and adopted. And I was struck by seeing all the places, I would say 95% of the time in that document, they really were on the right side of history in terms of the things that they were advocating. But they had, as I saw it, this one blind spot, a moral blind spot, when it came to their addressing what they saw, and indeed what is the very terribly destructive aspects of alcoholism, and some of the results of their irresponsible consumption of alcoholic beverages. This is a malady we continue to struggle with, and we pay a price for it to this day. So their blind spot was not in recognizing a problem. It wasn't recognizing a moral issue. Instead, it was in becoming so fixated on a particular solution that they were blinded to some of the actual outcomes of the solution they were advocating. This is the same blind spot that my friend and colleague, and I'm pleased to say, still living and breathing colleague in the UU ministry, the Reverend Forrest Church, identifies in a book he titled The Seven Deadly Virtues. For those who didn't catch the full meaning of that last sentence, Forrest continues to deal with terminal cancer. As of this date, he is still dealing with it on this side of the curtain. Well, I refer to this book of his. He's written a slew of them, but I've referred to this book of his in other sermons, and I'm going to revisit it this morning for the light I hope I can shed on our topic. But the question raised in this book is how that which is truly virtuous or seemingly virtuous can turn into deadly virtue. The quick answer is that deadly virtue occurs when the pursuit of something that may well be good in and of itself becomes so paramount and so narrowly focused that certain other values and moral principles get run over. Well, there's any number of places we could go with this subject of deadly virtue, including one that makes the moral blind spot of the prohibitionist look downright benign. This past Tuesday, our Unitarian Universalist Association's President Bill Sinkford and the director of our UU Service Committee's Charlie Clemens joined with the National Religious Campaign Against Torture to call for a commission of inquiry into the practice of torture done in the name of this country over the past 8 years. Reverend Sinkford and Mr. Clemens have released an open letter to President Obama on this matter, which I'll take up shortly. I'll back up just a bit first. Terrorism itself is one of the most blatant and deadly examples we have of deadly virtue. Whether it's flying a plane into a building of innocent civilians in New York City or bombing a federal building in Oklahoma City, both of these deeds, and many others we could cite, were done by persons who truly believed they were fulfilling some great and higher and noble purpose. And I'm willing to ascribe, since I have no knowledge to the contrary, initially good motives to those in high positions of power in this country following the attacks of 9/11 in their desire to protect this nation from any such further horrors. I realize as well, and I do appreciate, that it is part of the job of those who are charged with the security of this nation to extract information from and about those who would do us great harm if they had the opportunity to do so. Note, however, I said initially good motives. As the information that has been released in recent days clearly indicates, somewhere along the line, and quite early on, things went terribly wrong, as cruel and humane, to say nothing of illegal, methods of interrogation were used in the name of our country, supposedly to prevent further cruelty and inhumanity against us. The actual outcome, however, was to create even greater enmity towards us. As the Sinkford Clemens letter states, United States-sponsored torture clearly encourages reciprocal treatment against our troops and spreads anti-American hatred. I can understand any reluctance on the part of our president to put this issue on a front burner, given everything else he's got on the stove and in the oven right now. But I also have to agree with our association's president when he calls on our nation's president to support a commission of inquiry into these very serious and documented incidents of torture. I'm going to read a couple lines from the letter now. Under your new leadership, we are now at a critical point in our nation's history and have the hope of reclaiming our reputation as moral leader of the free world. It is not enough to simply promise to stop doing what we know is immoral and illegal. We must show we mean it when we say never again by making public the whole story, including how the horrific practices came to happen and who is responsible for authorizing. I've left some copies of this entire letter on our information table if you'd like to pick it up and take a look at it. It includes information on how you can add your name to it if you wish. It's also posted on the UUA website where names of supporters can be gathered there as well. But staying with my overall theme of the morning, I'm going to add a word of personal caution here before moving on. I intend to add my support to Reverend Sinkford and Mr. Clemens' appeal to the president. And while I'll admit I might gain some personal satisfaction, even admittedly feel some glee in seeing those who have besmirched our country's name be brought to some form of accountability, if that's my motivation in supporting this call, then I have fallen prey to my own form of deadly virtue. The motivation for any of us who would support our association's president on this matter should and must be to recall our country to the principles and values and the ideals for which it stands, period. Of course, one way to avoid this deadly virtue trap or to not let your good intentions lead to less than good ends will be to not take a stand on anything, not stick your neck out on anything. But all that leads to is deadly indifference. Here again, I go back to what Dr. Church in the book I've been referring to calls the 60% principle. He says if you think you're correct, at least to the 60% level, in your position on an issue, then run with it. Put your stake in the ground and stand by it. But however passionately you may act and advocate for your cause, keep that 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 degree of certainty tucked somewhere in the back of your mind. That way you leave yourself open for any correction that might be needed. I've looked to abide by this principle in the same-sex marriage debate that is now taking place in our state. Most of you know I'm a very strong supporter of this move. I've testified before our state legislature to that effect. And I was very delighted by the action of our state senate this past week. I dearly hope our governor, even if he cannot in good faith and conscience feel he can sign this piece of legislation, will allow it to become law for the sake of the civil rights of the gay and lesbian citizens of our state. And I'm going to say I feel 95% sure I'm on the right side of this issue. And that other 5% is really my window of willingness to be proven wrong if some kind of sociological or psychological or anthropological or any other logical kind of evidence can be found that would demonstrate how allowing same-sex adults to marry would harm the overall fabric of our society. For I see no such evidence. What I do see, right here in this congregation, are some very fine and loving and dedicated to each other same-sex couples, some of whom are raising some very fine and wonderful children who are among the children who gathered with us at the front of our, the front of our sanctuary a little earlier today. And that's good enough for me. And I hope our governor will do the right thing by them. I'm going to wrap up with one more line from Forrest Buck. He says, apart from community, righteousness becomes self-righteousness. Try that one again. Apart from community, righteousness becomes self-righteousness. While we rightly praise those admirable individuals who take the courageous and sometimes lonely moral stance, more often than not, those same individuals have the wisdom to turn to a community of some kind where they could work out their stances. They did so with a community, with a circle of associates that they could trust and rely upon, and some kind of a critical dialogue was called for. I've noted this, and I've been impressed by this as I've read some of the biographies of Martin Luther King that are out there. He was a very courageous and often lonely individual, but he also remained in intense dialogue with certain trusted friends and associates as he honed his positions and took his actions. He knew that in the last analysis, there'd be many instances where he would be the one out there as the lightning rod for racial justice and for peace. And in the end, he often would retreat into his own thoughts, into his own prayers, before he made his move. But he also always relied upon trusted associates to keep his righteousness from becoming self-righteousness. The greatest piece of wisdom I feel we can possess is knowing that we are creatures of partial or limited wisdom. Such knowledge must not, it need not immobilize us, but rather it should keep us in concert with the values and the virtues we strive to uphold. And this is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons that we have a community like this one here. A place where we can engage in open, honest, and respectful dialogue when it comes to determining how we can best live out the values we hold. Reverend Richard Gilbert says that one of the purposes of a liberal religious congregation is to bring people from the I of individualism to the we of community. The I of individualism to the we of community. For it is in such a community as that, then, that our values are tested and reshaped and redefined. Finally, the best way to deal with this dynamic of virtue and deadly virtue is to remain mindful of one of our more definitive liberal religious precepts, which is that there is always more light to be revealed, more truth to be discovered about the truths we hold dear. No canon of virtue is ever closed. What we finally do have to do, while we finally have to do what our minds and what our hearts tell us is right, we must also keep our minds and hearts awake and aware of those new truths that are always yet to be revealed. And as our closing hymn tells us, it is the law of love that should always be our guide. So let's sing that together. It's number 131. Love will guide us.